The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
You're listening to Facing Evil, a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individuals participating in the show and do not represent those of iHeartRadio or Tenderfoot TV. This podcast contains subject matter which may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Facing Evil. I'm Rasha Pecoraro.
And I'm Yvette Gentile. This week, we are talking about the murder of Kara Knott. And this case is, it's a very surreal and creepy one because it's one of those where you say, this could totally happen to any one of us. It's when the person you trust in to protect you ends up being the person you should be the most afraid of.
Yeah, sadly, you're so right, Yvette. And of course, for those of you who have been with us from episode number one, this case, at least for Yvette and I, reminds us of our very first case from our hometown in Honolulu, Hawaii, the cold case of Lisa Au. And it's sad. This was only 4 years later after the case of Lisa Au happened. Lisa Au is still a cold case. She was murdered on the side of the road in 1982, and this happened in 1986. But there's differences in this one, and we get to talk to an amazing expert who's going to walk us through the entire case. And his name is Jim Trainum. He is an expert in forensic evidence and criminal procedure, and he's going to talk to us about everything. And so thankful. He's such an open book and an open heart.
Yes, and it's going to be an amazing conversation. But now our producer, Trevor, is going to walk us through today's case.
A 20-year-old San Diego State student was murdered by an on-duty CHP officer in the North County.
The main unanswered question is how she was able to be either duped or conned into stopping. And we don't know why.
It was 2.5 weeks after the murder that homicide detectives went to Pyers Poway home and led him away in handcuffs.
Every day of the trial has been like attending Kara's funeral over and over and over again.
Kara Knott was a 20-year-old woman who was mysteriously found dead in 1986 in a ravine near San Diego, California. Knott was a student at San Diego State University. She had plans to get her doctorate and become a teacher. On the night of December 27th, 1986, she was visiting her boyfriend in Escondido, who was sick with the flu. People who knew Kara said she was very considerate and often overly cautious. For example, she always locked her doors and never picked up hitchhikers. Just before 8 p.m. that night, she called her parents, who lived 45 minutes away, to let them know she was coming home. But she never arrived. Kara Knott's family set out to find her that very night. Around 5:30 in the morning, they found her car parked off of the Mercy Road off-ramp. 3 hours later, police found her body, strangled and thrown from a bridge. But there was no sign of sexual assault or robbery. The passenger door was locked, but the driver's side window was partially rolled down. Earlier that night, a witness saw a police officer pull over a car at the Mercy Road off-ramp. They described it as a VW, light blue. Kara drove a white VW. And just before 10 p.m. that night, Two women said they saw a police officer named Craig Pyre at a nearby gas station. He had blood and scratches all over his face, and according to them, he was acting incredibly nervous. When he returned to the police station a half hour later, his coworkers say he was, quote, bloody and disheveled. He told them he had slipped and fallen into a chain-link fence while getting gas. Pyre had been with the California Highway Patrol for 13 years, and by all accounts, his career was the most important thing to him. Pyre's fellow officers called him, quote, hot pencil. This was because he gave out more traffic tickets than anyone else, about 250 per month. He would often rant to his colleagues about highway safety and keeping the public safe. Soon, though, it was revealed that there were two sides to Officer Pyre. There was devoted police officer and something else, something more nefarious. The California Highway Patrol was getting reports from young women that he pulled over, saying he was engaging in off-putting behavior. After pulling them over, he would sometimes order them to his favorite spot off the I-15 freeway. At that point, he would ask them about their love lives, or sometimes get into their cars and take them on rides deeper down a vacant lane called Mercy Road. 2 days after her murder, Officer Pyre appeared on a TV news special, giving tips on how to stay safe as a driver at night. Scratches were still visible on his face as he talked. And on January 15, 1987, Craig Pyre was charged and arrested for Carinot's murder. After two trials, he was convicted and sentenced to 25 years to life. But to this day, Pyre, his family, and his friends all claim he would never commit such a violent act. However, others claim differently. And so, what happened to Kara Knott? Was Officer Craig Pyre actually guilty? And what does the debate surrounding his guilt tell us about the reliability of evidence versus witness testimony?
So the murder of Kara Knott brings up a ton of questions. Questions about procedure, evidence, the list goes on and on. And today we have an expert with us on all of these things. His name is Jim Trainum, and he's a retired homicide detective for Washington, D.C.'s Metropolitan Police Department. But his resume goes far beyond that. He's written a book called How the Police Generate False Confessions, and he is a recipient of the Ethics in Law Enforcement Award. Jim, e como mai, or welcome to Facing Evil.
Well, thank you very much.
So I just told our listeners just a tiny bit about you, but I'm hoping that you can tell us a little bit more about your career and how you got started and how you got into doing all of this today.
Well, I spent over half of my 27 years with DC, DC Police Department in the homicide branch. And what happened early in my homicide career actually shaped, you know, the rest of my life, really. And that was in a very high profile case, one of the first cases I had, I obtained a false confession from a totally innocent person. And I did so using the standard interrogation techniques that we were taught and that would pass muster in any courtroom in this country. And I wanted to find out not only how did I convince this person to confess to a crime that they didn't commit, but also how did they know all the details about the crime that, as we love to say, only the true perpetrator would have known. And so that kind of started me into looking into how things like confirmation bias and other factors can adversely influence the way that we do investigations. And so I began teaching other law enforcement officers how to avoid the same mistakes that I made.
Oh, wow.
And I began working on other alleged wrongful conviction cases, doing case reviews in general. And yeah, I was just finding out there's so much that when it comes to how we analyze evidence, so oftentimes we make mistakes in the way because of the way that we think and the way that we process, and and also other pressures like the pressure to close the case quickly and things along that line. So since I retired in 2010, I began to use what I learned in reviewing cases, not only active, you know, murder cases, cold cases, but also cases that were alleged wrongful convictions. And I testified in several of those cases that's all around the country. And I continue to teach and learn as well. I'm still taking classes. In fact, I'm taking one coming up very soon from the UK on basically how to think like a detective. Something we
Wow. Even though it's something you already know, but you can always evolve and already learn, right?
There's so much out there that, like I said, we're basically taught the mechanics of how to do our job, but there's so much lacking in how to think about how to do our job. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that they excel in over there. And so I'm hoping to use that in order to help create more training programs and help improve law enforcement practices here in the U.S.
Beautiful. I love that, Jim. That's so powerful that you said that because, you know, you're retired, but yet you're still evolving and still learning. And I just do have one question. When you were talking about the technique, I was listening to you on a podcast and it was called the Trust and Justice Podcast. And you were talking about that particular technique, which was the Reed technique. And is that what you were taught early on, you know, in the very beginning when you got that false confession?
Yes, I was taught not only the Reed technique, but, you know, the thing is, there's a lot of different interrogation schools out there, but the majority of them teach a variation of it. And it's an accusatory approach. And unfortunately, the way that it's designed, they promote it as a way of getting to the truth. But unfortunately, the way it's set up, you're trying to get to the truth that you believe it to be. And so you know, what you're looking for so much is not information, but confirmation. And if you happen to have the wrong person to begin with, then, you know, that just sends you further down the wrong path.
Right.
There's been this new movement within the criminal justice system that they're trying to set up what they call sentinel event reviews. It's like if there is a failure of some sort, either maybe a case goes unsolved or a wrongful conviction, rather than look at the individual causes like we're so good at and blaming individual people, we're trying to look at the big picture. Because let's say, like in my case, you know, yes, I got a false confession, but, you know, let's also look at all the other things that influenced my decision at the time. There was some faulty forensics, poor supervision, pressure to close the case. It was a high profile case, things along that line. And so when you look at the big picture and understand all the contributing factors and you're transparent about it, then not only can you work to correct all of those things that contributed to the problem, but you also gain more trust from the public because you're willing to admit that, yes, we made a mistake. Here's a mistake, and this is what we're going to do to fix it. I believe that's the way in the future to go towards, you know, helping to resolve the trust issue that we have.
Absolutely.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
So let's just jump right into it. Let's talk about Karanat. How familiar were you with this case? You know, for us, like when we first started researching this case, immediately you think the CHP officer, he had to have done it. Was that your first reaction as well?
Well, it's never my first reaction. I've reviewed all of the, you know, public information that's out there as much as possible. I've dug into it as much as I can. And so I haven't been privy to a lot of the internal reports and things like that that oftentimes offer really important nuggets. But when I start looking at a case, I don't really have any preconceived notions as to whether or not it's him. I'm going to look at the evidence and see, first off, the evidence, was it obtained reliably and was it analyzed properly? Because that's where you tend to have your failures. And so going into it, yes, he was convicted and all of that, but I've worked a lot of cases where it looks like a slam dunk at the beginning. But once you get into the nitty gritty of it, the evidence kind of starts to not be as clear as people try to make it out to be.
So, Jim, with all of that being said, full transparency, I am married to a retired police officer. You know, she's asked me not to say what city she worked for, but she did work in the state of California. But I was talking to her about this case and I told her we were interviewing you. And I was like, babe, like, what do you think? Like, do you think, like, one, like, why would this CHP officer, you know, pull Kara Knott over? And like, why would he be driven to do this and then go, if he did do it, right? And then go right back to the rest of his shift. And she told me, she said, you know, I feel like it's more common than we'd like to think because it's about power. And I was like, really? Like, it just, for me, my mind doesn't think that way. So do you think that it is about power?
Looking at it at first, I try not to go in there with that perception. That doesn't mean that I haven't formed an opinion.
Right. You're right. Human.
Right.
Yes.
And the courts actually, you know, have convicted him. Now, this is a very circumstantial case. I mean, this is old school. They solved it the old school way.
Sure.
You know, they didn't have cell phone tracking stuff. You don't have surveillance videos. You don't have, you know, the DNA, all the stuff that we rely on so heavily to solve cases today. And it is very circumstantial. However, it is a very strong circumstantial case. Even if you want to discredit some of the evidence that would no longer even be considered in a court today, such as the evidence about the rope,
the fibers.
Forensic dentist said that he was able to match the rope that was found in the car to the marks on her neck, and there were like identical lengths and things like that. All of that stuff has pretty much been, you know, discredited.
I see.
It's not, you know, accepted as, you know, scientific evidence anymore. Fiber evidence is highly questionable. And there's been a lot of abuse of findings about fiber evidence in the past in court. But even taking all that away, my first thought is that, you know, this is probably the first time he ever killed anybody. This is, you know, but we know based on the evidence that he did lure or did take several women down there. And if I was a betting person, I would bet that at some point in his career, you know, before all of this, he actually engaged in sexual encounters down there. That this was something that, I mean, why would you keep doing it?
What's the point?
If you failed, you know, each and every time, why would you keep trying this? And in this case, something just went wrong. Even though he was a patrol officer, you know, he probably didn't have any comprehension about how homicides are investigated, about, you know, what kind of clues he could have left behind because he wasn't trained. He didn't have any experience in that. And so, I mean, he just panicked. And he did his best to cover up, but he didn't have any other option but go back to work.
Right. To continue on like normal.
But the fact is, though, there were witnesses that actually saw him. You know, there were people at the convenience store, the gas station, that saw him in there and they visibly saw scratches on his face. And there was another witness that saw him take her down, you know, that Mercy Road, or saw the car there. I mean, doesn't that say like a whole lot right there? You know, and then he goes on television and, you know, gives this statement with the scratches on his face after he's done this.
he probably didn't have much of an option. Yeah. I mean, the scratches are there. And so he has to explain them somehow. I mean, he can't avoid that whatsoever. I mean, he tried to cover his tracks. He tried to modify his logs and things along that line in order to make it look like he was somewhere else. He did what he could. He did what he could to create an alibi. However, some things he just could not hide.
Yeah.
But like the TV thing, I mean, that was the area that he patrolled. And so I suspect that his supervisors just put him up and say, look, we want you to do this. It's not like he volunteered for it. And so he just had to put on a brave face and go about it. And if he had refused to do it, I think that would have caused more immediate suspicion at the time.
Right. For sure. I do want to ask you, Jim, and I know you were telling us about, you know, the fibers, not that forensic evidence, not necessarily holding up in court today. But the other thing that I'm curious about, so like, would it be considered part of, again, like, is this circumstantial evidence or is this actual forensic evidence? The fact that Pyre's blood type is a rare blood type and is type AB, and that was on Kara. That's not just a coincidence, right?
Well, it's also circumstantial evidence because it's not like DNA today where you can say like the odds of it being anybody else is one in however many trillion, quadrillion or whatever along that line. You know, that blood type is about 18% of the population.
Okay.
And so that's a lot of people that it could be. However, the a defense attorney fallacy, they call it, is when you look at an isolated piece of evidence and you try to discredit it like they did by saying, look, that's 18% of the population. There could have been thousands of people who could have, or millions of people who could have left that. But yeah, but there weren't millions of people who were taking women down into that area, who were acting inappropriately with them, who were there that night, who did A, B, and C. So all of that combined makes a very tight case.
Like the perfect storm, as one of our former guests told us. Yeah.
It's so interesting to me. You know, I just want to talk about the fibers, like, because, you know, we do know that from his little badge, you know, on his uniform, that yellow fiber was actually found on Kara. Why can't they use fibers? Like, what is the argument against it? I guess I should say.
The main argument is that one, it's kind of subjective. It's based on a visual examination. That material could potentially come from thousands of different sources and all that. But the problem has been is that examiners have overstepped their bounds when they're testifying. Now, in this case, from what I read, it appears like they didn't do that. They said that they were visually similar. However, in the past, other examiners have said, no, it's an exact match, or I've never seen anything, you know, like this.
Right.
And so that's why, you know, fiber evidence has led to exonerations in the past, primarily because the examiners have overstepped their bounds.
Got it.
However, in this case, from my understanding, there was also the addition of the dye in the fiber itself.
The color.
Dye actually matched up right there. So not knowing anything about the dye part, you know, I would say that, that's a very interesting, you know, piece of evidence right there. And so I'm not really sure how admissible that would be today. But even without that evidence, take the fiber evidence, throw it away. You still have a case.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, I think the behavioral evidence is one of the, you know, the strongest pieces of circumstantial evidence. I mean, in looking at a diagram of how the road was laid out and all of that, him going down there on a regular basis. And really, there was no need for him to do that. I really find fault with the supervisor at that point. If they had complaints, which they did, about women down to that isolated area. Well, first off, I mean, for officer safety, I don't know what their policy is during that time period. I was working as a uniform patrol officer during that time period. If you had a traffic stop, you called it in.
Right. That's what my wife was saying. Yeah.
You call it in because you want
backup.
It's for your safety so that if something happens, they know who you're stopping and where you are.
And he didn't do that in this case, if I recall, right?
I don't think he did it in a lot of the cases.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to spend, 30 minutes, talking to somebody like he did with a lot of these women.
Right.
And all of that. Because your supervisor is going to call you out. So that should have been a red flag. If he got complaints from at least two women that I know of, that he was taking them down to that location. Plus, you don't want to get yourself in an isolated spot, where it's dark. That just increases the danger to you.
Right.
Outside of everything else, that should have been a huge red flag for them to go, wait a minute, why are you doing this?
Doing our research, there was even like a joke with other officers, other CHP officers that, how many people did you pull over today?
He had a high rate, didn't he?
Yeah, he was known for pulling over, and especially women.
Well, that was also a different time back then.
True. It was the 80s, yeah.
I mean, people would make jokes. I remember during that time period, or maybe before, there was a DJ in D.C. that would do a skit where it would involve officers actually, no uncertain terms, committing rape during traffic stops.
Yeah.
They were making jokes about it.
Right.
And so, I mean, as horrible as that was, that was kind of like, something that people really didn't take seriously. They kind of made fun of it.
Mm. Right.
And that kind of makes, like I said, it makes me believe that he was at least successful in having some kind of sexual conquest in the past. And that's why he continued to follow this pattern.
Right.
So it was basically a shotgun effect. He would just try it. And if it worked, it worked. If it didn't, it didn't.
So, Jim, one of our first episodes that we did was a case in Hawaii about a young woman by the name of Lisa Au, and this was in 82. And this is still an open case. It had to do with supposedly a police officer or somebody impersonating a police officer, where this young woman got killed and she was left in the hills of Tantalus. And she was there for approximately about 10 days. But this goes to the question of forensics, right? There are so many things that they did wrong in that case. And now we're in 86 with the Karanat case, right? In that time frame, would the forensics, had it advanced at all in those 4 years?
Not all that much.
Mm-hmm.
I think the disadvantage that you had in 82 was the fact that the body wasn't found for quite some time.
Right. Yeah. 10 days is a long time.
And it was in the rain. And yes. Mm-hmm. But
you also had that gap between, when she went missing and when she was found. And here you didn't have much of a gap at all.
No, because her family
went out searching for her ASAP. Yeah.
And they had a lot of good luck.
Yes.
The fact that she stopped at the gas station. So they were able to put up a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, stuff really hadn't advanced all that much during that time period. And also, remember, different agencies had different forensic capabilities.
Yeah, that's Honolulu PD or CHP. Very different, I'd say. Yeah.
We really don't have any kind of standards across the country in law enforcement here.
Yeah.
Is it still that way now, Jim?
It is still that way now. I mean, it's not like the UK, where they can come up with a single set of operating procedures and best practices and all of that. Here you have 18,000 different, kingdoms across the country with different levels of capabilities, training, and everything else. And so sometimes it's just a, luck of the draw.
Yeah. It's so true, though. You have to think about that. Like, they did have so much luck. I mean, of course, you don't want to think about it's lucky to find a beautiful young human dead, but at least they were able to find Kara and seemingly get closure because, Officer Pryor was convicted. But all of that put aside, I am curious, Jim. I mean, you've alluded to the fact, of course, we think that, Pryor may have sexually assaulted other people, but for all intents and purposes, he wasn't convicted of anything prior to this. What do we think would make a seemingly, I know there's no such thing as normal, but a seemingly normal
CHP officer be capable of this?
That's a hard question.
It's not really a hard question. You know, one is power.
Yeah, power. Mm-hmm.
It's possible. Like one of the first encounters was one that was consensual. And I mean, that is possible.
Certainly.
Right there. Mm-hmm. And so he just got this idea in his mind that, you know, hey, there are women out there who are turned on by this, you know, by cops and all that sort of stuff. And there are women who are attracted to male police officers and also vice versa. But
sure. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, they're attracted to the power thing and all of that. But for him to have killed her, I think that something just went totally wrong. He had no plans.
Yeah.
There's no indication that he got any plans to do this whatsoever, mm-hmm. or that he would have done this again in the future unless he got kind of caught up in this situation.
Right.
I just think so, whatever happened, he panicked and he did what he did. And he just did not know how to cope with it afterwards. You can really get away with murder. If you plan it, I mean, if you really think about it, I mean, if they get a stranger on stranger cases, no connection with them, make sure nobody finds the body, you know, that sort of stuff. But he didn't have time to do all that.
No.
So he had to do something because he was also under a time constraint.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
You know, another thing that is really interesting is his family. You know, his family really believed that he was innocent because they truly believed that the evidence wasn't strong enough. What do you think? I mean, I think we are all in unison of what we believe, but his family still believes that he didn't do it. Because again, like you said earlier, right, it was all circumstantial evidence.
Before I went to homicide, I worked burglary cases, and I loved working burglary cases because they're a lot like serial killers.
Oh.
Because typically there's no witnesses. You know, because a burglar is careful. They don't have to commit the burglary, and so they do it in such a way that if there's a witness there, they'll back off or whatever. And so typically what you do is you rely on forensics and you rely on patterns and things along that line, circumstantial evidence, if you tie them to, you know, the stolen property because they sold it, stuff along that line. And so people think circumstantial evidence is a dirty word. It really isn't. You don't need to have an eyewitness. You don't have an eyewitness in a lot of murder cases.
True.
That's the best you can do. But of course, you know, they believe him, just like the confirmation, confirmation bias, just to clarify in case people don't understand what it is when you get a belief and then you begin to search for evidence that confirms that belief,
mm-hmm.
rather than search for evidence that, you know, impartially. Mm-hmm. And so you're very selective. And so a lot of times you'll see family members on both sides, whatever, they will kind of cherry pick you know, what they want to hear
and what they don't mm-hmm. want to hear.
They'll cherry pick, you know, or kind of, well, she said this time or this that time. Well, it might not be relevant. It might not make any difference. But because they come up with a little discrepancy, they think that wipes away, you know, all of the evidence right there.
Yeah, which of course it does not.
It does not.
But I feel for them. I understand, you know, what they're saying. And so they're victims too. Of course.
Yes.
I couldn't agree more. With all the cases that we cover on Facing Evil, we know that there's not only one victim ever. It always affects all of the families involved, whether guilty or not. And yeah, it can be heartbreaking at times. It absolutely is.
It is, because it changes lives on both ends.
Everybody's, but like in wrongful conviction cases and exonerations, a lot of times, you have the family members who are just devastated because they have put so much faith in the prosecution and in the police officers.
And
so
injustice.
When the potential for exonerations first comes up, that's who they turn to. And so a lot of times the cops and the prosecutor would say, no, this is, you know, BS. They're just trying to pull some, you know, shady stuff. There's actually organizations out there now that work with family members who are going through this just to kind of help them through the process, which is a good thing, because before they were isolated on their own. And everybody was concentrating on the person getting exonerated, but nobody was thinking about the victim and the victim's family.
Yes, that's beautiful. I love, the more support there is out there for people going through anything, this especially, I think, is beautiful. Jim, I would like to ask, with all of your expertise, can you tell us, did you agree with the final verdict?
Based on the evidence that I've seen, I do agree with the verdict. That, you know, there is, let's say, beyond a reasonable doubt that he is guilty.
Certainly.
That's such an interesting question that Rasha asked. And then when you put that in there, because the fact is that the jurors, weren't they like 7-5 the first go around with him?
So funny, because I've actually had cases where it was 11-1 hung jury for a conviction. And then the second time around, it was a straight up acquittal.
Really?
Wow.
Thing is, a lot of times people will ask me during a trial, what is the jury thinking? What do you think about? I have no clue.
If you can understand every single human on the face of the planet, then maybe you'll have a clue. Yeah.
Probably not even then.
That's so true.
But so much of it depends on their own personal experiences, you know, their own, you know, biases and things along that line, you know, their own life stuff. But also, oftentimes, and I hate to say it, you know, the way the evidence is presented.
Yeah.
I know that they switched attorneys. And so all of that comes into play.
Yeah.
That's why the system is so imperfect.
Yeah.
It's also one of the reasons why, you know, I'm not a believer in the death penalty, because there's so many variables that go into a jury's verdict.
Yeah.
As much as they're told, you're only supposed to consider the evidence. Each person considers it differently, you know, based on their life.
Yeah.
Right.
Their own experiences.
Yep. We know that Pierre, he's been up for parole a few times, right? And he's been given an opportunity to present DNA to the Innocence Project. And I'll let you speak to that, because I know you said you've worked with this particular nonprofit, but he has denied to take it. Doesn't that say that I'm guilty?
Well, not only has he refused to take it, but he also refuses to give an explanation as to why.
Oh, he hasn't said why.
Just to clarify something, there's not just one Innocence Project. There are multiple ones around the country. You know.
Oh, okay.
And I can see why, like on the surface, they may want to look at this case, especially when they start seeing things like, you know, the evidence about the marks on the neck and the fiber stuff. They might want to consider it. But when it comes to DNA stuff, I mean, that's the low-hanging fruit for them. And you wouldn't believe the number of cases that I've worked where there was DNA evidence that could be tested, but the prosecutor fought it tooth and nail, mainly because we have this belief in this country that verdicts should be final, that the family shouldn't have to go through this stuff. That once it's done, it's done. So that's something that you always have to fight against. So if he's being offered the chance to do something that could really potentially clear him 100% and he's refusing, I think that's good circumstantial evidence in and of itself. But like I said, he's not giving a reason. And, you know, the other thing going against him is all of these people who have been exonerated, who've been up for multiple parole hearings. One of the reasons that they oftentimes were refused parole was that they kept saying, no, but I didn't do it.
Aww.
They want them to accept the responsibility, but they won't do it. In his case, he still says that he won't do it, but he doesn't take the chance that's offered to him.
To exonerate himself.
Or to explain.
I say that, but it might come back inconclusive just because of the way the evidence was kept or all kind of things that might not allow testing of the evidence.
You know, we always like to look for the light, of course, on Facing Evil. And there have been a few, you know, positive developments that came out of Kara's case. So Sam Knott, who was Kara's father, he lobbied to pass a bill which at the time would have allowed women motorists to stop at places that they felt more comfortable or more safe being pulled over. Now, sadly, although it didn't pass, I think it started the conversation at least. What do you think?
I know that a lot of places, if you're pulled over by an unmarked unit, that you're able to go to a place that's well lit, that's safe, you know, that sort of thing, just because yes. In the past, they've had people posing as police officers who have the lights and all that kind of stuff mounted inside their car, but the car isn't visibly marked. The problem is that you have a rogue cop here. So typically, if you have a unit that is highly marked as, you know, as a police officer, that sort of thing. But even these days, you have the extra advantage of if you are pulled over, you can get on your cell phone.
We did not have that in 1986.
See, one of the things you can do, okay, you're pulled over by the California Highway Patrol. You can dial 911 saying, I'm being pulled over. Is this legit?
I love that.
I believe we can absolutely, and you correct me if I'm wrong, give credit to Kara's father, Sam Nottigan, because he fought for this, you know, this $83 million communication system that enforcement agencies now have and emergency agencies have to help coordinate where, you know, something may be going wrong. Unfortunately, you know, Kara didn't have that.
Back then, I would not have been aware of any kind of system like that that existed. So, you know, once you have a problem like this and once you identify, just like I talked about before, you can then come up with solutions to the problem. And oftentimes, you know, law enforcement, unfortunately, is very slow to responding. You know, they kind of dig their heels in. They're going to blame it on the one individual rather than realize that this could be part of a larger problem. Or if we did have this system in place, then this one individual couldn't have done this anyway. And so a lot of times it does take pressure from family members, from the media, from politicians and all of that. No, law enforcement, they hate two things. Basically, the way things are and change.
Is that an oxymoron?
Absolutely. So they're going to be, you know, we don't have a problem because we fired them. Well, yeah, you do, because anybody else could, you know, do this similar, you know, start falling into this pattern of inappropriately pulling over women and engaging in inappropriate conversations with them. So there's a system. So that not only protects the driver, but also protects the officer as well.
I would love to know, because I see that glimmer and hope in your eyes. I would love to know what light in the darkness of Kara's story that you can take away or give to our listeners.
Well, you know, one of the things that you had mentioned earlier is the mention that the family got closure.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I mean, I worked with a lot of families, especially in these unsolved cases and all that. And I would meet with them on a regular basis and talk to them. And one of the things I kind of caution them about is, you know, you're looking for closure, but it's not going to come because, you know, you're going to get a conviction. You know, they're going to go to jail and your loved one is still dead.
Still gone.
However, I encourage them, just like with her father, to try to, you know, do something meaningful. Now, it doesn't have to be as big an event as what he did, but it's just like there's organizations out there. you know, support organizations for other, you know, crime victims and, you know, family members of homicide victims and things like that. And they can help you with your pain, but you can also turn around and share your experience with other people who are also in that similar situation. And you can turn this around and actually, you know, help somebody else and do good and make that part of your loved one's memory. I don't care what they were doing when they died. I don't care, you know, about any of that stuff. It's still a tragedy, and you can still improve somebody's life or improve the system by going that extra mile, bonding together and working as a group.
So beautifully said. Paying it forward.
And working together.
Jim, it's been a true honor to have you on the show. Thank you for being here with us today.
Well, my pleasure. And I hope that I did add something to this case and kind of explained a few things. And thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Today's Imua is dedicated to Kara's parents, Sam and Joyce, and the entire Knott Ohana. After her death, Kara's father, Sam Knott, successfully lobbied for a bill that allowed women to stop at places they felt most comfortable when being pulled over. Instead, the state Senate voted in a bill that further punished drivers for not pulling over as directed, sadly.
But Sam Knott, he persisted, and he convinced several local law enforcement agencies to change the way they handled nighttime stops for women.
And because of Sam Knott's work, San Diego County now has an $83 million communication system that allows law enforcement to communicate with emergency services in a way that wasn't possible on the night that Kara was killed.
And the Memorial Nature Preserve, where he planted and raised oak trees from acorns, is still there. It is called the Kara Knott and San Diego Crime Victims Oak Garden.
Today's final message of hope and healing goes out to the memory of Sam Knott, as well as to Joyce Knott and the rest of the family, who in the aftermath of the worst tragedy of their lives, persisted for justice, persisted for hope, and persisted for humanity. Onward and upward, Imua.
Imua.
Well, that's our show for today. We'd love to hear what you thought about today's discussion and if there's a case you'd like for us to cover.
Find us on social media or email us at facingevilpod@tenderfoot.tv.
And one small request, if you haven't already, please find us on iTunes and give us a good rating and a good review if you like what we do. Your support is always cherished.
Until next time,
aloha.
Facing Evil is a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. The show is hosted by Rasha Pecoraro and Yvette Gentile. Matt Frederick and Alex Williams are executive producers on behalf of iHeartRadio, with producers Trevor Young and Jesse Funk. Donald Albright and Payne Lindsay are executive producers on behalf of Tenderfoot TV, alongside producer Tracy Kaplan. Our researcher is Carolyn Talmadge. Original music by Makeup and Vanity Set. Find us on social media or email us at facingevilpod@tenderfoot.tv. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio or Tenderfoot TV, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Do
you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach, Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit TrinitySchool.org for more info now.